Support for WMNF comes from our members and AEG Live, presenting London electropop indie band The XX. The XX is at the Ritz Ebor February 7th. More at Ticketmaster.com. I'm Duncan Strauss, really delighted bringing you another edition of Talking Animals, in which we'll discuss salamanders. And how a number of salamander species are disappearing from the wild at an alarming rate, with salamander advocate and conservationist Matt Ellerbeck. First, though, we're kicking off the show with an animal tune, a highly relevant one, from Jethro Tull called Salamander. Here. I'm Talking Animals. That was Jethro Tull with Salamander, an animal tune of sorts. He leads us into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name's Duncan Strauss, here with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, Matt Ellerbeck, who's a salamander advocate and conservationist. Ellerbeck, who's known as the Salamander Man, will address how a number of salamander species are vanishing from the wild in rapid fashion, why that's gone largely unnoticed and underreported, perhaps, and what can be done to mitigate the problem. We'll talk salamanders with Matt Ellerbeck presently here on Talking Animals. And while speaking with Matt, we'll also welcome your questions and comments at 813-239-9663 or by email at dj@wmnf.org. Also, a bit later in the show, we'll step into the Comedy Corner. We'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a copy of Dancing Dogs, collection of short stories by our recent guest, John Katz. Also later in the show, we'll speak with Rick Shabadie, Executive Director of Suncoast Animal Leagues, about their huge adoption event, Dogtoberfest, taking place this Sunday, November 10th at Highlander Park in Dunedin, featuring, among many other activities, the running of the wieners. Right now, though, it's time for the Animal News and Announcement segment, a look at items of interest in animal news, as well as announcements of local events on the horizon. Produced, as always, by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Reed News Department. Our first item, well, of course, we have to at least briefly acknowledge the election. We're going forward, right? On a presidential level and more broadly, without some of the kooks of various stripes. Turns out pro-rape isn't a viable platform after all. And also moving forward with the first openly gay senator and all kinds of interesting developments. Some of the states and some really cool, promising new folks holding office. And also got, again, right, even on my side of the state, unseated Ellen Bogdanoff, who reported on this at the time, had sponsored an amendment lifting a ban on artificially dying animals, like the cord of dying for like Easter and other things. Anyways, for a bunch of reasons well beyond that, she was defeated by Maria Sachs for the state Senate. So good news in many ways there. And just generally, I want to, a lot of this has been covered by Rob and Randy and Bill earlier today and elsewhere. But just a quick shout out before we wrap up and move on to more animal oriented things to Nate Silver, whose 538 blog and its various calculations helped comfort me in the days leading up to yesterday when polls looked really, really tight and things looked pretty dicey. So, Nate helped keep me calm and pull me through, and boy, was he right and then some, right? All right, just want to continue to sort of update you on this whole Bill and Lou situation. Again, that's Bill and Lou are the oxen at Green Mountain College that worked there on their on-campus farm for 10, 11 years, and then Bill got one of them got an injury or re-injured himself, and they got retired, and then they were both decided by the college that they would be slaughtered, and the results of that would be food for the campus dining service. So anyway, since we first reported on that, there's been a lot of not only media coverage, people writing and signing petitions, phoning and emailing the campus. And so anyway, the good news at least is that the slaughter has been postponed. Originally that was slated to happen by or before even, I think, the end of October. And there's been quite a wave of protest, concerns even by local slaughterhouses and threats, I guess, issued there, figuring that that's where Bill and Lou would go. So they've kind of backed off, and other things have happened, including PETA asking that the slaughter be done publicly. So the college's position, unfortunately, seems unchanged overall, but, they are at least holding off, and so again, it's never too late to have your voice heard on this. There's a Facebook page devoted to Bill and Lou. As far as I know, the petition site, the petition on petitionsite.com, will still be signed, and you can otherwise contact the campus and register your feelings about this decision for Bill and Lou. So we will continue to keep you posted, of course. Meanwhile, we are in the midst of, among many other things, obviously, National Animal Shelter and Rescue Appreciation Week. So, again, a great time to support local shelters and rescue organizations, as well as those, obviously, in the Northeast that were impacted by Hurricane Sandy. So, just some numbers, there's about 3,500 animal shelters they figure throughout the U.S., providing safe haven for an estimated 6 to 8 million homeless animals each year. And, of course, local rescue groups try to fill the gaps by taking in additional pets. And so, there's a quote here, shelters and rescues need the support of their communities to cope with the sheer number of animals that need homes and respond to emergencies like Hurricane Sandy. Heather Bialy, Director of Animal Director of Shelter Services for the Humane Society of the U.S. So there's a few ways to get involved if you're inspired by this being National Animal Shelter and Rescue Appreciation Week. Of course, you can adopt a pet and encourage your friends, relatives, and neighbors to save lives by doing the same. You can volunteer at a shelter or rescue organization. Obviously, some of you already do that in huge ways. They could always use more help, more people, more hands. And, of course, you can donate funds or supplies. So shelters and rescues are often in need of, well, so many things. Towels, blankets, toys, supplies, food, and more. So been thinking about helping out, getting involved with your local shelter and rescue. What a great, perfect time. Sort of, especially if you're buoyed by last night's results. And kind of on a related note, just want to read this little blurb. Rumpelstiltskin, an 11-week-old black kitten, is the 25,000th animal adopted from Tony La Russa's Animal Rescue Foundation since the organization's founding in 1991. And 21-year-old organization has been rescuing abandoned animals from overcrowded public shelters since its humble beginnings, when dogs and cats were cared for in foster homes and business was conducted from headquarters located in the back room of the ARF thrift store. That first year, 157 animals were adopted, says Executive Director Elena Bicker. Last year, the organization placed 1,974 dogs and cats in homes, and now operates from a 37,000-plus square foot state-of-the-art animal community center opened in 2003. So good for them. And, of course, if you've been listening for a while, you might remember that Tony La Russa was a guest on Talking Animals about 5 years ago, December of 2007. And a lot of people have been taking all kinds of political action and through yesterday, but you can take some more as soon as today. Pasco County is considering an anti-tethering ordinance that will stop the source of significant abuse of dogs in their community. And not only is unintended tethering a public safety issue, a child can be bitten in a matter of minutes, but the dog can be strangled, stolen, attacked by other animal or cruel people, etc. There's weather issues and more. So today, Wednesday, November 7th, there is a public hearing set for historic Pasco County Courthouse, boardroom second floor. That's 37918 Meridian Avenue in Dade City. Find out more information if you want to check back with us, dj@wmnf.org. And, of course, you can therefore speak on behalf of animals, and then there's actual talking animals on Talking Animals. Story made the rounds. And, but we got to get in on it too, feels like. A zoo elephant in South Korea can speak Korean out loud. Researchers say the pachyderm is capable of saying hello, good, no, sit down, and lie down, all by using its trunk to do the work of lips. In a process scientists don't fully understand, the elephant likely does not understand the actual meaning of what he says, researchers said. Past reports have suggested both African and Asian elephants were capable of vocal mimicry, like parrots. African elephants have been known to imitate the sound of truck engine, and a male Asian elephant living in Kazakhstan Zoo was said to utter sounds resembling Russian. But that case was never investigated scientifically. Scientists investigating an Asian elephant known as Koshik say the beast can imitate human speech, pronouncing words in Korean, and those who know the language can readily understand Koshik. He accomplishes this in a very unusual way, using his trunk stuck inside his mouth. Elephants cannot use their lips to make sounds like humans do, since their upper lips are fused with their noses to form their trunks. Instead, Koshik somehow controls the sounds coming from him by moving his trunk inside his throat. It's an elephant story. It's a talking animal story. That's everything I love. All right, so we have more stories. We'll try to get to them if time permits a bit later. Right now, though, it's time to step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. This is Mark Maron, the host of the celebrated podcast WTF and a past guest on Talking Animals, with a piece called Masturbating Around the Animals on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Here's a question for you. A little window into my life. I'll share it with you again. You know how hard it is to masturbate in front of four cats? You know how hard that is? I'm assuming dogs are easier. I don't own dogs, but I guess they just want to be part of something, huh? That's really up to you, depending on how slippery your personal moral slope is and what you can rationalize effectively. But I got four cats on my bed, and they will just sit there and quietly judge. I take it out. They're like, really? Really? We're doing that again? Really? Does that make you feel better, sad man? Does that make the pain go away? Well, we'll just sit here grooming until you get done with your pathetic autoerotic hobby. But I'll leave him on the bed. I don't put him off the bed because I never want to hear myself say, Daddy's done. Come on back up, Caleb. I'll just shoot myself in the head if that happens.
All right. That was Mark Maron with a piece called Masturbating Among the Animals, taken from his album Final Engagement. We also want to give a shout-out to Mark's cat, Boomer, who's been missing for several weeks now, and urge Boomer to come home. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals, our website. It's talkinganimals.net. It's time to speak with today's guest, Matt Ellerbeck, the salamander advocate and conservationist known as the Salamander Man, here to talk, that's right, salamanders. So, with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Matt Ellerbeck back to Talking Animals. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. How are you today?
Good. Thanks so much for joining us again on Talking Animals.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You bet. So, again, you've been on the show before, but still, for those who, you know, may not remember, didn't have a chance to listen, I think it's, you know, be useful just to hear a little bit about your background and how you became interested in speaking on behalf of critters of various kinds.
Well, when I was a kid, I spent a lot of my time with my grandparents, especially the summertime. So I would be camping and cottaging and things like that. And in doing so, I would often come across reptiles and amphibians. And that's really where my passion and interest started, right from when I was a little kid. And I have, you know, many vivid memories of encountering salamanders and snakes and snapping turtles from a young age and, you know, throughout my life. So it's an interest I've had lifelong. And then in 2004, I started to correspond with the local conservation authority and their educational officer, and that's when I developed an outreach education program, which would have me doing presentations and lectures and raising awareness about these species, their conservation, and most importantly, how people can get involved. And now with a more specific focus, as you mentioned, on salamanders.
Right. So we'll get into salamanders deeply in a moment, no doubt. But it seems like as you kind of explain that history and sort of how you came to salamanders now, I mean, it does seem like, I don't know, might you be sort of a serial advocate or conservationist? I mean, when you were on Talking Animals before, about in 2010, I think it was, we were talking about snakes. And then I think when I first encountered you, we were kind of focused on scorpions. At one point prior, I think, it was turtles. So how much of this pattern is these species kind of maybe not holding your interest as vividly after a certain point versus moving on to other species that you feel maybe need a little more of the Ellerbeck treatment, the TLC, et cetera?
I think it's just a very natural sort of evolution as far as being an advocate. I mean, what you touched on is correct. I've done advocacy and conservation projects concerning snakes, turtles, scorpions. So I think the common parallel between all of those creatures are they are very misunderstood. I think if I – and I love all animals very much, but I think if I was to do, say, a campaign on – you know, I live in Canada, on polar bears, for instance. You know, although I love all animals very much, it's just not where my heart is. I mean, I feel that I specialize in really trying to bring attention and awareness to the misunderstood creatures of the world, not so much the charismatic mammals. And I think that's what I do. I help people empathize with these creatures that are often stigmatized as ugly or slimy or scary, and you have all these, you know, negative, you know, stigmas that surround them. So that's, I think, it's just been a natural evolution for me. Mm-hmm. I started out with snakes, and then I ended up talking about scorpions and snapping turtles, and how it came to where I am now with salamanders is earlier this year when I was still doing a number of turtle talks, and I was just, you know, winding down to the end of that as far as all my obligations were concerned, the number of presentations I had booked, et cetera. And I was just getting ready to plan my next batch of outreach activities. And a lot of the people that wanted me to come to certain events or expos and things like that and do displays or presentations, there was a number of other reptile groups that were going in a lot of cases. So it would have been me and maybe one or two other people that would also be talking about snakes and turtles. So I noticed in my area there's been, which is fantastic, but there's a lot more attention going out for these animals, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I actually had encountered a number of salamanders in the wild, and I hadn't seen any for quite some time. And that sort of got me thinking about it. I thought, no one really talks about salamanders. I mean, in my travels, I've met, you know, lots of people who are quite passionate about all sorts of animals and doing all sorts of things to advocate on their behalf, and especially other reptile people. Again, it's very snake and turtle centric, and I thought, that's, you know, no one really talks about salamanders. And then them being amphibians, if you look at a lot of amphibian conservation websites and campaigns, they're very frog focused. So all these things were happening at once. I thought, you know, there's a lot more outreach going on in my area around snakes and turtles. So I thought, maybe I'll do something else. And mm-hmm. then I'd seen these salamanders, and that sort of just, you know, started the process of thinking, well, these animals really do need an advocate, I think. So that's sort of what led me into this direction. So again, I think it's just been a very natural evolution for me. I don't, you know, sit down ahead of time and, you know, flip through a big animal book and say, oh, that's kind of neat, maybe I'll talk about that now, or
right.
that I lose interest in something else. It sort of just happens naturally on its own.
Sure. No, it sounds like a confluence of factors, starting with, yeah, as you say, I mean, it wouldn't be as practical probably for you to be a polar bear advocate. It sounds like really a key thing was when you were younger, as you explained to us, just that time you spent with your grandparents in and around areas where you then would encounter a lot of those kind of reptiles and amphibians. That sounds like that was kind of had a huge impact on you there. And again, just by proximity, I mean, what sort of critters you're, you know, your day-to-day encountering probably, of course, has really shaped this too. So, and then it sounds like also now you've filled that all-important salamander niche that you saw was being unfilled prior to you stepping up. So, It all makes sense. Let me just let folks know, this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, we're speaking with Matt Ellerbeck, salamander advocate and conservationist. If you'd like to ask Matt a question or offer a comment about salamanders, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. So let's do a little Salamanders 101 then, Matt, if you don't mind, a quick sort of overview, starting with, of course, what exactly is a salamander?
That is a great question to begin with, because so many people don't know, and this is actually how I start most of my salamander talks and presentations, is establishing just what they are. So a lot of people assume salamanders are a kind of lizard. That's not true. They're not lizards, or they're not reptiles at all. As mentioned before, they're amphibians like frogs and toads, and they're their own group of amphibian. And an easy way to distinguish, say you're out hiking somewhere and you run into a little lizard-like creature and you're not exactly sure if you're looking at a salamander or a lizard, an easy way to tell the difference is salamanders have no scales. They have very smooth and almost slimy-looking skin, and they have no claws, while lizards have dry, scaly skin, and they have little claws on their feet in the most cases. So by just looking at them and sort of looking for those specific features, you can identify very easily if you're looking at a salamander or a lizard. And then when you hear terms like mud puppy, water dog, newt, a lot of people are not sure exactly what those creatures are. Those are all types of salamanders. So when someone says a newt is not its own distinct group of amphibians. A newt is just a common name that we give to specific salamander species, as are mud puppies and water dogs. And some, you know, depending on what part of the world you're in, and different individuals may use some of those terms interchangeably between several species, but they're all salamanders.
Okay, so then that, I think that brings me to maybe the next key question. How many breeds of salamanders, or species, I should say, sorry, of salamanders are there worldwide?
550, which sounds like a massive number.
Yeah.
But it's actually quite small compared to frogs, which there's thousands of species. And we mentioned snakes earlier. There's
sure.
the 3,000 snake species. So in terms of some of the other reptiles and amphibians, it is a smaller group, but there's still, you know, tremendous diversity among them. 550 species global is quite a lot. You're based in Florida, correct?
Yes, Tampa.
So you guys have about 39 species in your area. Now, up in Ontario, where I am, we have about 12 different species. So certainly we're on the northern limit of a lot of the ranges of reptiles and amphibians up here.
Well, so yeah, it's just what you've said there makes me wonder, are there certain areas internationally where you tend to find sort of large concentrations of salamanders, or are they kind of, you know, spread, at least in some numbers, across many, many continents?
Well, they are found pretty much worldwide, minus most of Africa, most of the Middle East and Australia they're absent from.
Okay.
The Appalachian Mountain region is where they reach their greatest diversity. So, and a lot of people, when they think of reptiles and amphibians, they think of the tropics immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Amphibians, especially salamanders, actually prefer, in a lot of cases, cooler climates. So sometimes temperate forests and moist and cooler environments are usually more, you know, adapt for salamanders. Those are things that they prefer. So that's why the Appalachian Mountains region, and that's why up in Canada, where we have only one lizard species in Ontario, but we have 12 salamanders, because, again, they can tolerate cooler temperatures a little bit better.
Interesting, yeah. Okay, so already got a few folks who want to speak with you, and we'll get them involved in a sec, but I guess of the 550 species that you mentioned, how many are in sort of imminent threat of extinction, or you know, how many were there maybe that are now gone to leave us at 550?
Well, there are several species that have already gone extinct, and when we're talking about a conservation of any species, you know, that is an extremely significant and powerful statement. I mean, extinction is forever. They're gone, and we're not talking about, you know, dinosaurs, of course, are the most famous example of a group of animals that have gone extinct that happened through sort of natural changes in the environment around them. These are animals, in the salamander's case, that have gone extinct because of what we're doing to them, some of the threats that we're causing, some of the degradation that we're doing to the natural environment. So several species have already gone extinct, and half of all the species worldwide are listed as threatened by the International Union for Conservation of Nature, and that's the world's foremost authority on the conservation statuses of species. And then you have another 62 or so species that are designated as near threatened, so they're not quite at that at-risk stage yet, but they're headed that way, and a lot of those species have populations that have been identified as declining. So they're experiencing that downward drift, and they are headed towards that direction. So salamanders are in, you know, an extreme state of peril right now, and unfortunately they don't get much attention.
Wow. Okay, so this now actually raises a bunch of questions in my mind, but let's at least get one of these callers on that's been holding for a while. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Matt Ellerbeck.
Hi, is that me?
Yeah, sure is.
I was just wondering, can you use a salamander the same way you use a gerbil for sex?
Okay, very sorry about that, Matt.
You get the thumb in every crowd, right?
Right. Well, and also for better or worse, we don't screen calls on the show, so I guess, you know, that's occasionally
going
to happen.
Well, there are listening. I will say I definitely don't advocate for using salamanders in such a way.
All right. Well, there you go. well done, sir. But how much of the threats that you just kind of outlined for us about half of that 550 being threatened and the 62 more near threatened. Does that vary a lot by geography? Because it sounds like you've already alluded to sort of habitat and degradation and destruction of that being kind of a key factor. I mean, is this vary a lot, therefore, those numbers that you just gave us by where things are in terms of geography?
It's a pretty much a global phenomenon, and it's happened. And I should mention, you know, it's happening to frogs too. I mean, the state of amphibians everywhere is not very well, and that's to say that a lot of the threats are experienced all over the world. Things that are happening that are causing population declines in salamanders here in Ontario are similar to other parts of the world, you know, the United States, Europe, Asia, things like habitat destruction, the introduction of pollutants and contaminants into the environment, fragmentation of natural areas, road mortality. I mean, there's roads everywhere all over the world now, and they run through, in a lot of cases, which was once pristine habitat and natural areas, and certainly a lot of salamanders have to go through migration in the spring and the fall to breeding pools or overwintering sites. And when you have a lot of small animals crossing roadways where they're not very big, they're not very quick, you know, a lot of them get killed that way. And you also have things like, you know, chemicals entering water bodies, and climate change is a huge one.
Well, let's talk about that, because, you know, that seems very much part of the, at least national, if not international, dialogue at the moment, again, in the wake of Hurricane Sandy in particular. So how has that impacted the salamander population?
Well, to understand that, you have to think of what a salamander needs to thrive. I mean, amphibians are very sensitive. That's why they're called bioindicators. So in areas where there's lots of amphibians doing well, means the environment is in a good state. When they're not doing well, it's an indication that the environment is suffering very badly. And for salamanders to thrive, they need very specific temperatures, moisture levels, humidity levels. You know, everything has to be, they really do require optimum conditions. And when you have a change in climate and you have the temperature rising in certain areas, it can really affect the overall state of that habitat, which can, you know, really decimate salamander populations. For example, a lot of salamanders breed in vernal pools, so temporary pools in the spring. And when you have warmer temperatures that are not common to certain areas, those vernal pools are going to evaporate more quickly, which means the salamanders are going to lose their birthing sites. The salamanders that have already had their young in those areas are then going to become trapped. Most of the salamanders that are born actually have external gills, and they actually start in sort of a larval or tadpole stage. So it really does lower their reproductive output and things like that. So you can understand by just very simple changes in temperature or humidity can really, really affect them quite drastically. And climate change is not easily combated. And many authorities believe that climate change is to blame for the disappearance of salamanders in otherwise pristine habitat. I mean, you can have, you know, nature reserves and nature sanctuaries and conservation areas set up where those habitats are going to be protected from development or, you know, deforestation, things like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, climate change has no borders. So they might be safe within that area from some threats, but still that change in climate and that global warming is still going to be able to reach them. And when certain authorities were studying salamanders within protected areas and they found that they were still dwindling, that was a pretty big red flag that, you know, climate change is a very serious issue for them.
Right, because it sounds like in those examples you've allowed for or really removed all the other factors that otherwise could affect the salamanders or diminish their populations, and yet that's still happening, so that only leaves climate change.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, so let's hopefully have better luck. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Matt Ellerbeck.
Hi, I have a few questions. Are salamanders cold-blooded like reptiles?
Yes. Cold-blooded is sort of an outdated term. A better way to look at it is what's simply called ectothermic, which just means that they warm themselves or cool themselves by just sort of taking advantage of the environment around them. So if they get too hot, they would move into a shady or cool area. If they're too cold, they would try to move into an environment that's going to be a little bit, with the ambient temperature is going to be warmer. That's why snakes and turtles, for instance, will lie out in the sun to warm themselves up. That's not to imply, though, that they are cold-blooded, as in they have cold blood. I mean, an ectotherm that is out in the sun basking, their body temperature can actually be warmer than that of a mammal's. So I hope that's not too technical.
No, but in other words, they don't generate their own heat like like mammals do.
No, yeah, it's not. It's, yeah.
Okay, so the other question is, the Olympic rainforest, the only temperate rainforest in the world, is that a common place for salamanders? You said the Appalachian mountain chain.
Yeah, they are common within that area, too. And that's the problem with, I mean, Appalachian's region is heavily targeted for coal mining, and many of these other forests, temperate and tropical, are both targeted for, you know, habitat loss, deforestation, and things like that. So one of the big threats, and that's why I want to touch on this quickly, that they face is in the areas that they're often most diverse in are very heavily exploited and you know, subjected to these habitat destruction.
Okay, you mentioned two amphibians, frogs and salamanders. What other amphibians might we be familiar with?
There's one other group. So you have frogs and toads. Toad, like I mentioned with the word newt, is just a word for a more terrestrial species of frog. So aside from frogs and toads, salamanders and newts, there's also something called Sicilians, and they look a little bit like a cross between a giant earthworm and sort of an amphibious snake. They're a legless creature, and they're found mostly in the tropics. So people outside of, you know, parts of South America are not usually very familiar with Sicilians, but they're the other group of amphibians that people might encounter if they're from that region, or even if you're just researching amphibians, that reference might come up.
Thank you for all your questions, and those were good questions. I appreciate them. Matt, we're sort of just nearing the end of our time, so I want to be sure that we have some time at least to discuss the sort of efforts to you know, help the recovery or protection of some of these species. We've covered things, and for example, you know, maybe we can talk about some things that we can really do, those of us listening, to help our salamander friends. I mean, I don't know that there's a lot we can do at the moment directly about climate change. I don't know if you happen to see that Frontline piece a couple weeks ago. But there are some formidable, even more than I probably had recognized, forces, you know, trying to work against any sort of even still acknowledgement of climate change, and then getting politicians, you know, wiped out of office if they acknowledge it, which is probably why it didn't come up a lot in the recent election. But anyway, I digress there. But what can we do? Because I know that I think you're of a mind that legislative efforts are sort of all well and good, but what's required here is more of an individual effort to affect change when it comes to salamanders. Does that sort of characterize your position pretty well? Or?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I'm all about educating people and getting them to hopefully be inspired to want to make that change on the individual level, and then hopefully by doing that, you know, can sort of lead by an example. So for people that are concerned about salamanders and want to help, you can visit me at SaveTheSalamanders.com, and my website is designed purely as a hub of information where you can learn more detailed information on the threats, but more importantly, what you can do to help. There's a how you can help page just full of simple things that, you know, the everyday single person could do in their lives that will make a positive impact for salamanders. And I think that's the really important thing when people think about, you know, various environmental and conservation related issues. They think, well, what can I do? You know, it's that sort of cliche, I'm only one person. Well, I've made it easy for you. There's lots of information on there. For what you can do, there is a climate change page where it does talk about things that people can actually do to drastically lower their carbon footprint, such as dietary changes, things like that. There's also a link on the How You Can Help page about 50 simple things that we can do to help the environment that will also help lower your carbon footprint and hopefully contribute to alleviating climate change, and lots of information about habitat management. So if you live in an area with lots of salamanders, or you have a cottage near a woodland and you want to just, you know, take care of the area around that spot a little better, that will help salamanders, you can do that. So there's lots and lots of information on there if people want to get active and involved, which I hope they do.
Sure. No, it's a great, great resource. And probably just in our final minute or so here, Matt, but here's a question that came through the email. How do salamanders get along with Florida gecko lizards?
They probably don't actually encounter each other very much because, again, geckos, like a lot of reptiles, will seek out generally hotter environments,
mm-hmm.
while salamanders like cooler and moister environments. So although their ranges might overlap, within that range you're going to have microhabitats, which will have areas more specific to the needs of that species. So, for instance, you might have a woodland area where you might have some species up in the trees that might be actively seeking out sunshine to warm up, while you might have other species like salamanders that are actually going to exploit fossil and subterranean habitats within that region if it does get too hot or dry for them.
Okay, cool. Well, that takes care of that question. Just before we sort of wrap up here, Matt, among the things we didn't really get into, but I hope are sort of implied, at least for a show like this, if not even in terms of the conversation we had. But, you know, if anyone is find themselves at a pet store or somewhere else where somehow salamanders might be available, obviously we want to strongly discourage purchasing any kind of animal, really, but certainly a salamander, given this conversation.
Absolutely. And the salamanders are often, and that's one thing I didn't talk about, amphibians of all kinds, not just salamanders, but are often caught from the wild to be imported for the pet trade. So the wild-caught trade in animals, it also does severely affect them. So I'm glad that you brought that up as well.
Okay, Matt. Well, thank you very much for joining us again on Talk Animals. Again, we've been speaking with Matt Ellerbeck, the Salamander Man. And again, website chock full of great information is SaveTheSalamanders.com. And he's also on Facebook. You can just search the Salamander Man there, and it comes right up. So thanks again for joining us. Thanks for all your great work and information, Matt. And keep up the great salamander efforts.
All right. Thank you. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks so much. All right, I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. This is a giveaway. You do not need to be a WMNF member to win. There'll be a prize, a copy of John Katz's latest book, Dancing Dogs, to the first person who calls in the correct title of this animal tune to 813-239-9663. In a moment, we'll speak with Rick Chabity about this Saturday's big Doctober Fest event. Right now, it's Name That Animal Tune. I'm Talking Animals.
Ooh, back up on my cow and woe. Here I go, swinging low. Bye-bye, blackbird. Well, somebody waits for me. Sugar sweet, and so is he. Bye-bye, blackbird. Because no one here can love or understand me. Ooh, what a hard luck stories they all hand me. Daddy, so you make my bed and light the light, because I'll be home later on tonight. Blackbird, bye-bye.
All right. We've got a few folks who probably think they know. Let's take them in the order they came. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune? Hi, can you name that animal tune?
Bye-bye, Blackbird.
Yeah, come on. We made it so easy. We're trying to, we're giving things away today. It's the day after the election day. All right, what is your first name?
Clark.
What is it? I'm sorry?
Clark.
Can you spell that? I can't.
C-L-A-R-K.
Oh, okay. Cool. And, all right, well, you are our winner, and we'll come back and get your information when we can and send you off a copy of John Katz's new book, Dancing Dogs. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we do have a winner. And right now, let's welcome back to the show Rick Chabity. Rick, are you there?
I'm here, Duncan. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals. And let's remind folks you're on the show, but let's just briefly at least, sort of outline this is we're about to talk about an event produced by Suncoast Animals League and which you're, executive director of. So why don't you just give us sort of the nickel tour of what Suncoast Animal League is?
Well, we're an animal shelter. Of course, we deal mostly with cats and dogs. But we also deal with wildlife and exotics and such. So, we're pretty well-rounded group. you know, we're, although I'm not crazy about the term no-kill shelter, you know, we do not euthanize here. You know, and we're just continuing to grow and grow and grow. And, you know, we assist, you know, obviously locally, with cats and dogs, but we also deal with animals from all over. We just had, first thing this morning, actually, about 3 o'clock this morning, we had 10 dogs, 10 small dogs come in from a West Virginia shelter that was affected by Hurricane Sandy.
Wow. Okay. So you're sort of taking their, overflow, or just there's just no capacity.
Yeah. It's kind of an unusual thing that happened up there. They had, these 10 dogs were from a puppy mill kind of situation. Most of them are Chihuahuas, Chihuahua mixes. And, they were actually scheduled to be euthanized because of overcrowdedness, and tropical, or the Hurricane Sandy hit. And the veterinarian that was to come in and actually put these animals to sleep, couldn't get in because of the storm condition. And so these guys were actually saved by Sandy.
Wow, that is an unusual story. So given that, they've sort of just been given a complete sort of reprieve, for lack of a better term, or?
Well, it's another odd thing that happened is a gentleman that just recently adopted a dog from us happened to be up in West Virginia. He heard about their plight, and he was to fly back down here on Monday. He ended up staying, actually getting the dogs out of the shelter for us. We sent the shelter all the, you know, necessary paperwork. He put them in a vet's office for a couple of days, and then he went ahead and rented a car instead of flying back and drove all 10 dogs back.
Oh my goodness, this is a odd but very cool confluence of factors, certainly. So
I know sometimes just, you know, strange things happen.
Yeah, well, sounds like it's great to happen in this direction. Okay, so speaking of dogs, on to Dogtoberfest. Tell us what it is and where it takes place, and get into some other good details in a sec.
Okay, Duncan, this is our 5th annual Dogtoberfest, and one thing that's a little bit different about this one is it's, we're calling it a super pet adopt-a-thon. We normally at our events have 22 or so, rescue groups there with adoptable animals. This year we're going to have 50 at this event. It's going to be the largest pet adopt-a-thon in the history of Northern Pinellas County.
Wow.
I know we're bringing about 30 dogs ourselves that'll be there. We've got groups from all over the county, from all over the Bay Area of the state, and actually, I think we have one rescue group from out of state, and and that's going to be a huge part about it. PetSmart is sponsoring that part of the event for us. But
and Rick, was it just kind of the obvious thing of, hey, the more groups and the more animals, hopefully the more adoptions, or why this year, if you've done it 4 other years, why kind of basically more than doubling the number of groups?
Well, it's, you know, it's exactly what you said. The more groups, the more dogs,
yeah,
the more choices, and therefore the more adoptions.
Sure.
We're hoping.
Yeah.
And, you know, and certainly we want to get our dogs adopted out there, but we also want to give everyone else a big chance. I mean, you know, some groups don't have the abilities that say some of the like we do, or animal services or SPCA or something like that have.
Yeah.
So this gives them an opportunity to get out in front of a huge crowd of people.
Sure.
And show them what they've got, and hopefully it'll help get some of these dogs adopted.
That's great. Well, you know, I guess. Go ahead. Sorry.
But along with that, I mean, we're going to have over 100 vendors, and it's all kinds of vendors. Of course, it's food vendors. We have a beer garden set up there. But it's, you know, most of the vendors are selling dog related products, but not all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all kinds of things out there. There's arts and crafts and stuff too. We're having different contests. We're having the Doggy Project Runway Costume Contest, which is hilarious. I mean, it's really good. We're having
speaking of hilarious, I've already taken a couple opportunities to mention it, but we got to talk at least briefly about the running of the wieners.
Oh, that is an incredible thing to be there and to see. We normally have anywhere from about 45 to 90 dachshunds that, that race in there.
Yeah.
And it seems to keep building. And it's pretty funny because the owners are pretty competitive. We have age groups and in the categories and such. And we have great prizes for the winners and such. But it's hilarious because people will stand around and watch. And actually, we have our, what we call our wiener holders. And they will actually watch how they release the dogs because that we have our volunteers that are holding the dogs at the one end. The owners go to the other end and jump around and blow up balloons, whatever they need to do to get their dog's attention and get him across the finish line. That's what they do. And so they will actually study to see, oh, maybe this wiener holder holds on to the wieners too long. Or this one launches them a little bit and gives them a little start, you know.
Wow. So
they'll come in and actually request who holds their dog. And
there's sought-after wiener holders, I think is what you're saying,
yeah,
Rick.
Wiener holders are a big part of the day there.
Yeah.
They're very popular.
So, Rick, you know, we may have glossed over this. Let me just say for everyone listening and hearing some of the cool things that are happening, this is taking place, again, this Saturday, November 10th at Highlander Park.
Yeah, in Dunedin.
Yeah.
And it's actually where the community center is.
And it gets underway at 11 a.m., I believe. And
it does.
Yeah, and it runs through 4, I think, with the dog stuff. And then there's, at that point, I think live music kind of kicks in for a few hours after that.
Yeah, that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
And the best way I can describe this is it's just a fun day. There's tons and tons of dogs out there. We have our King and Queen contest that will be finalized at the event. We'll announce our King and Queen of Dogtoberfest and the court and such. It's a good day. Even if you didn't have any dogs, it's a lot of fun to come on out and just watch everything that's going on. And, it's just amazing to see all the different shapes and sizes, and different breeds and different mixed breeds and that. It really is a great day for the dogs.
Cool. Well, and also, you know, as you say, even if you don't have any dogs, all the more reason to come out there and adopt a dog, given all those cool groups and dogs that'll be available for adding them to your family. So
you're exactly right, Duncan. And the cool thing about this is, you know, you're going to have such a selection. And if you're wondering what kind of dog fits into your kind of lifestyle, this is an opportunity to go booth to booth, rescue to rescue, and talk to the groups who specialize in particular breeds and find out, okay, you know, this one isn't going to work at all. This one may be okay, but this would be a great fit into my house. And
sure.
So that's kind of what the day is all about. And, you know, you can get more information if you go to, we have a website set up just for this event, and it's called dogtoberfest.info.
Great. I was just about to announce that. So, Rick, okay, well, good luck. Thanks so much for joining us again and filling us in. We're looking forward to that, and I certainly got my eye on the running of the wieners for sure. So.
And, you know, I think next year, Duncan, we need to talk to you way in advance and book you as one of the wiener holders.
Well, I'm going to have to start my training now, apparently.
Okay,
Rick, good luck. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Duncan.
Okay. All right, we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday, November 14th, when our guest will be Lori Crawford, president of the Animal Network, Inc., multifaceted coalition in Manatee County, involved in adoption, spay and neuter, lobbying, legislative efforts, and more. And on Saturday, November 17th, speaking events, they'll be holding in conjunction with Bishop Animal Shelter, SPCA of Manatee County, the 14th annual Canine Christmas Festival, which features a number of shows, contests, and events, including an attempt to set a Guinness World Record for the most dogs doing a sit-stay at one time. So, Lori will speak with us about that and more on Wednesday, November 14th. Hope you'll join us, and also visit our website, talkinganimals.net. And stay tuned for the wonderful Scott Elliott and the All Souls edition of It's the Music, airing next from noon to 3. And I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. And, again, go to talkinganimals.net where you can find our link to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Our thanks, of course, as always, to our broadcast outreach consultant, Libby Busalis. And, so just coming up shortly, we have the NPR News and Scott Elliott with the All Souls edition of It's the Music airing next, noon to 3. Something tells me it's going to be an extra jubilant edition. of the old edition of It's the Music. And I want to quickly add before we run out of time here that tonight, Nova Science on PBS has a show called What Are Animals Thinking? And I believe it airs at 10 p.m. in most markets. So that'll be great. And anyways, all right, we'll catch you next Wednesday at 11 a.m. on Talking Animals right here on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. NPR News is next. Thanks. Take care. Congratulations.